week, we explore the wild side of Sochi, and I test my mettle. So join us for a series of challenges, from rushing rapids to free-falling over this gorge.
We're off to a world where time moves at a completely different pace, where it trickles drip by drop.
Sienny, nice to meet you. Peter,
over here. Good afternoon.
Now, with a total length of around 12 kilometres, the Vorontsov Cave Complex is one of the largest in Russia. How did you go about mapping it, and how did you not get lost here?
The Vorontsovskaya Caves, the largest cave system in the region, is the sixth largest in all of Russia. The explored portion, that is, the part that's actually been traversed by humans, is 11,640 metres long. From a hydrogeological standpoint, we conduct observations by tracing the flow of water underground. The water is dyed with a special tracer, which allows us to identify where it emerges in other springs and caves. In terms of hydrogeology, there are still many unexplored sections.
And how do you not get lost in them?
The cave is an enormous labyrinth. There are countless side passages, and they all look alike. An ordinary visitor would quickly get lost here. You're surrounded by branching tunnels in every direction, but with an experienced guide, you can navigate your way out safely.
So shall we go and explore them for ourselves, Arseny? I hope we don't get lost.
Let's hope so.
Is it true that dinosaurs still roamed the Earth when these caves were formed?
To be honest, I don't think that's true. However, remains have been found in the caves, specifically bear bones. In fact, you can see some of them right here. Archaeologists put them on display so visitors can get an idea of what a fossil looks like. It's believed that cave bears once inhabited the surrounding mountain areas, though they probably didn't live inside the cave itself. Over time, water washed these remains in from the surface. There is no decomposition taking place in the cave because of radon gas. The bacteria responsible for decay cannot survive. When a bone enters the cave, a process called calcification or fossilization begins. The bone develops a shell of calcite and limestone deposits. Organic tissue disappears, but the shape remains. When a fossil is removed from the cave and exposed to a different climate, it begins to deteriorate. Fossils are best preserved in the stable temperature and unique climate of the cave.
I probably should have asked this question before we came so deep into the caves. But how safe are they? How stable are they? Do parts of them ever collapse?
Well, as we cavers like to joke, statistically speaking, one rock falls every 100 years. But the cave itself is actually a shelter. Even during major earthquakes, the layered rock structure allows it to flex and absorb movement. The cave itself is safe to be in. The more dangerous areas are above the cave, near the entrances and exits, where surface rock can collapse. The cave itself is a natural structure and an exceptionally strong natural refuge.
So we're safer here than we are above the caves.
Exactly.
Okay, well, I think it's safe for us to go further into the caves.
Let me guide you there.
I've heard that the air here has certain medicinal properties. Is that true? And if so, what causes them?
It is true, yes. The air inside the cave is rarefied and ionized. This is because of radon and mineral salts. There's even a term for this, speleotherapy. Spelia refers to caves, and therapy means treatment. It's especially beneficial for people who suffer from asthma and other respiratory conditions.
So do people come here specifically for the properties of the air here?
People who know about its benefits come here for that reason, yes. Others learn about it during the tour itself while underground. Many of them make a point of returning just to spend time beneath the surface and breathe in the cave's unique atmosphere.
Amazing.
Hiking, climbing, swimming, abseiling, and a healthy dose of adrenaline Canyoning combines all of them in one multi-discipline sport, and today we're going to try it out for ourselves.
Nikolai, talk me through the equipment we have today to go canyoning. What are the basics that you need?
Well, first of all, you need protection from the cold water and from scrapes and knocks. For that, we use a wetsuit and a harness, so you can start working with the rope at any moment. It also keeps the wetsuit from wearing through, because we spend a fair amount of time sliding around on our backsides. In my backpack, I've got a rope, a first aid kit, and rescue gear.
Well, I hope we don't need the first aid kit.
Of course not. It just wards off evil spirits.
Right, should we do this then?
Yes, let's go.
To what extent does the thrill of canyoning come from the sense of danger, Nikolai? I know you do everything to mitigate risks, but it's still an extreme sport.
Extreme canyoning is what you get if you choose a really tough route. What we're doing here is more of an adventure. It means you feel the risk, but I manage it so that the odds of it actually happening are very small.
And the most extreme type of canyoning, how does that differ from what we're doing now?
It mostly comes down to the size of the obstacles and whether you can get off the route. Here, you and I will be jumping off small ledges and swimming, whereas in the difficult canyons, there can be waterfalls nearly 100 meters high that we rappel down on a rope.
Yeah, I don't think I'm ready for that yet.
And that's exactly what we've started getting ready for.
Jumping wasn't the hard bit. It's when you go underwater and you're surrounded by this loud, rushing river and it's absolutely freezing that a bit of panic starts to set in. But then you float to the top, you get carried a little bit away by the river, and then everything's fine. I'll tell you what, now I feel absolutely amazing that I've done it.
Waters shaped this region in extraordinary ways, and nowhere is that more evident than here, where a single mountain stream has created one of the most beautiful waterfall systems in the Caucasus.
Mikhail, nice to meet you.
Good afternoon. A pleasure to meet you.
Now, the park we're in is called 33 Waterfalls. Bit of a daft question. Is that because there's 33 of them?
Yes, that's the number, like in fairy tales. But it turns out it's not a tale or a legend at all. In 1999, an expedition from the Russian Geographical Society came here to the Jagosh stream. They carefully surveyed all of the stream's waterfalls, rapids, chutes, and slides. When all the measurements were completed, it turned out that the number of actual waterfalls was exactly 33. That's where the fairy tale number comes from.
Now, Mikhail, these waterfalls, they're so picturesque. There must be some local myths and legends about them as well.
Every waterfall, every mountain, every cave has its own legend. And the 33 waterfalls are no exception. Long, long ago, many hundreds of years back, people lived in this river valley, just like today. And there was a prosperous village here. Life was merry, happy. Everything went their way, and everything fell into place. Year after year, the harvests in their fields and orchards grew richer. Their herds kept growing larger. The people lived and rejoiced. But the world has its ways. Everything good has to come to an end sooner or later. And so it happened that a wicked new neighbor settled near the village, a huge giant named Inish, who started causing all kinds of trouble for the villagers. He trampled and ravaged their orchards and fields, helped himself to their livestock without asking, and would gobble up a whole bull in one sitting, an evil monster. Many warriors and heroes from the village, furious at the way the monster behaved, challenged him to one-on-one combat. But the giant was simply too big and too mighty. He was as tall as a whole mountain, and not one of the warriors could defeat him. In those days, in this village, there was a young man named Guch. He was ready to give his life for the good of everyone, yet he understood perfectly well he could never defeat such a huge and mighty giant. So Guch went to a wise old man for advice and told him he was ready to give his own life for the good of everyone. The old man thought it over. Then he said to Guch, "Who knows? Maybe you won't have to give your life after all. Take a great many barrels of intoxicating honey and set them out at long intervals along the river where the giant usually roams. And roll the last barrel up to the top of a high mountain and leave it there." And that's just what Guch did. So one day, the giant, roaming the valley as usual, came across a barrel of intoxicating honey. He picked it up with two fingers and drained it in a single gulp. He moved on through the valley and came across a second barrel, then a third. As he wandered through the valley, he drank up the honey and got drunker and drunker. At last the barrels ran out, but the giant's nose could still catch the delicious scent of the honey coming from somewhere. He turned his head this way and that and spotted one more barrel sitting at the top of the mountain. He started climbing, and he was so huge and so heavy that the earth could barely hold his weight. As he climbed the steep slope, his steps left deep, hollowed-out footprints. The giant took exactly 33 steps to the summit, leaving 33 stair-like footprints behind him. He reached the top, drank the last barrel, and now completely drunk, collapsed in a drunken sleep. That's when Guch slipped out of his hiding place and sliced off the monster's head with his sharp sword. To the young man's surprise, it wasn't blood that poured from the giant's neck, but water. And the stream never let up. If anything, it grew bigger and fuller. The water went rushing down along the giant's footprints, and that's how these 33 footprint steps came to be the 33 waterfalls. So that's the legend behind this place. Now, what do you think that was, the intoxicating honey mentioned in the legend? Bees make this honey from the yellow pontic rhododendron. And it has narcotic intoxicating properties. So this was a kind of weapon the locals had used since ancient times. And right now, the yellow rhododendron is just starting to bloom in our forests.
Sochi's climate allows plants from all over the world to thrive here. And in one park, you can travel across continents without ever leaving the city.
Galina, nice to meet you.
Good afternoon.
I've just been strolling around your park and I was amazed by the sheer diversity and range of the plants that you have here. A little bird tells me that no matter what time of year you come, whatever the weather, you can always find a plant that's blossoming. Is that true?
Yes, that's exactly it. You put it perfectly. We have a garden that blooms year-round. Every single day, we can find several plants in flower, even in winter.
And what can we find today that's in bloom?
Right now, our collection of cherry blossoms is in bloom, along with the magnificent wisterias and azaleas, which are a type of rhododendron.
Can you show me, please, Galina?
Let's take a look.
So rhododendrons, they produce quite a potent poison.
Yes, this is a poisonous plant that affects the central nervous system. If you eat any part of it or pick its leaves, which of course you shouldn't do. Some rhododendrons, including our forest variety, the one you call yellow azalea, can be very dangerous to smell.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, well, I won't be doing that then. From delicate flowers now to truly gigantic trees, I can't leave the park without seeing the sequoias, Galina. Can you please show me?
Oh yes, they're amazing. Let's go take a look at them.
So what is it about sequoias that lets them grow to such massive sizes, unlike other trees?
This plant is very fast-growing and powerful. Here in Sochi, when we planted them in the forest, they put on 43 cubic meters in a single year. That's several times more than the others.
And the bark's quite soft, though.
It's not just soft, it's also quite thick. It can be up to 30 centimeters thick, 30 or even 70 on an old tree. We don't have anything like that yet. Ours is still small for now. The point of it is to protect against fire. This tree comes from California. Fires happen often there, so it has to protect the wood somehow.
So given enough time, will this one here grow as big as its cousins in California?
We're hopeful, because even this giant here, standing 35 meters tall, is only 80 years old. It's still very small, very young, kindergarten age, really. It has a lot of growing left to do, because sequoias can live up to 1,000 years.
So with the changing of the climate, Galina, do you think we'll see more and more exotic plants here in this park?
Yes, we don't just grow these plants. We think about what comes next. As the climate changes, so will the vegetation around us, in our cities, in our gardens, in our vegetable plots. The conditions for endangered species in more southern regions will change too. We have to prepare for that. So we're collecting as many plants as we can and looking ahead to what the climate will be like in 2070 and which plants will help humanity survive.
If Sochi's a city of adventure, then Sky Park has to be its ultimate playground. Towering high above the forest floor, we're going to find out what this epic bridge and my nerves are made of.
Andrew, we're on the largest pedestrian suspension bridge in Russia. I've read that it can withstand earthquakes, hurricane winds, ice, rain, all at once.
Yep.
Not that you'd want to be on it during that. But what makes it so strong and stable?
Well, it was designed properly.
Yeah.
It was built properly.
Uh-huh.
It's maintained properly. You know, all of the above. It's super strong, man. Like, we've got these 854 mil cables,
uh-huh,
which are strung across the valley. You'll probably see at either end the little red hats in the foundations.
Yeah.
These are these massive big anchor bolts. They go from anything from 14 to 32 metres deep into the foundations, into the rock. Fill it up with grout glue. It's a solid structure, mate.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And is it difficult to maintain?
I don't maintain it. it keeps the guys busy, definitely. It's a year-round job, along with everything else that they've got to do, uh-huh, as well. It is a big task. It's a big project. But they do a great job with it, though.
But what a stunning view as well we get from here. Well, obviously, you know much more than me, Andrew, but bungee jumping, it comes from this tradition in the South Pacific where men would leap from these wooden towers with vines tied around their ankles, and it would be a sort of initiation transition into manhood. What would you say the sport is today? Is it also a sort of initiation of sorts?
It's going to be what each person makes it for themselves. You know, people are going to approach it as a personal challenge of sorts, like maybe they've got a fear of heights or a fear of falling. Some people are going to see the ego trip you go on. Mm-hmm. For others, it'll be a bucket list item.
Uh-huh.
We get quite a few people who have suffered a physical disability of any description, and for them it's about proving that they can still do these things. It's not a barrier.
Mm-hmm.
We've always said it's not really about kind of from the shoulders down to do the activity. It's more about the shoulders up and what's going on up in here. And those who want to do it, they're going to nail it every single time.
Well, I hope I don't bottle it.
You'll be fine, mate. You're going to love it.
Would you say it's a sport?
It requires active participation.
Right.
Okay, we're not going to push you off the edge. We're not going to sort of launch like a fairground ride. This requires each person to step at the edge and physically lean forwards and jump off a perfectly good platform into an abyss from 69 metres to 207 metres to other points in between as well. So by that rationale, you could call it a sport.
Yeah.
Each to their own.
Okay. Well, Andrew, it's been a pleasure to meet you. Wish me luck.
You're going to love it, mate.
Can't wait.
Ride the white lightning, buddy.
Thanks, mate. Timur, Peter, nice to meet
you. Nice to meet you.
I've got a ticket for one bungee jump here. I think I'm ready.
Are you ready to jump?
I think so, yeah, although my mouth's already quite dry.
Good.
This goes against all my instincts of self-preservation right now. Okay, let's do this. So I got butterflies in my stomach.
What is that?
Uh-huh. So the things I do for this show.
Mm-hmm. All right, Peter, you and I will be stepping up to the edge now. I'll be holding you. I'm not pushing you. This is your first jump. We jump on a countdown. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. When you hear one, you jump as hard as you can forward toward the horizon, as far out as you can, straight out into the horizon. And the most nerve-wracking moment will be on the ledge. It'll feel very scary standing there. Your legs will turn to jelly. Just try to keep looking ahead and do everything quickly.
Okay, not think about it. Not think about it. My mouth is so dry, even after the water.
All right, ready?
Yes. No.
We don't need music, do we? We do need support, though. Make some noise.
At least.
My God, this has to be the single scariest thing I have ever, ever done.
Excellent, Peter. We've reached the edge. Smile to the right for the camera. Smile right over there. Good. Super. Now we're ready. Look straight at the horizon. Breathe deeply. Get ready. And here's the countdown. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Go! Peter, bravo. Great jump.
Thank you.
How are you doing? How are you doing?
I'm a lot better now.
Get up.
Thank you, Timur. So I'm a lot better now. I'm on solid ground. But the advice not to think and just jump was probably the best advice anyone has ever given me.
Crazy.
But the G-forces, and I don't know, the emotions that you feel when you're heading straight towards the land is like nothing I've ever felt before.
You're going to have to jump again. The GoPro didn't work.
Technical take. Maybe a bit later. But that was awesome. Thank you very much, Timur. Спасибо.
Oh my God.
Need a minute or two, I think, to come round. But yeah. I don't know, you can't really explain in words what it's like the first time that you do it. But there was definitely a moment where I was on the edge and I thought, nah, I'm not gonna do this. It is really high. What am I doing? But then I remember what you said, don't think, and I just sort of went for it. And then, I don't know, it's quite a sort of strong force, isn't it, on you when you're falling down. But yeah, it was awesome. Thank you so much, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, let's see Badshire.